Hello, this is your Polycast for Wednesday, August 27th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, a man with Minnesota ties is killed fighting with Islamic militants in Syria. Home care workers vote to form a union, and police and body cameras. A 33-year-old former Minnesota resident has died in Syria. U.S. officials confirmed that yesterday. A report from NBC News said the man was fighting for the Islamic State known as ISIS. Peter Cox reports friends are trying to understand what happened to the man they knew in the Twin Cities.
The National Security Council said U.S. citizen Douglas McCain died in Syria. NBC News reported yesterday McCain was killed over the weekend while fighting for ISIS. They attributed the information to the Free Syrian Army and said photos of his passport and body were seen by NBC News. McCain grew up in Minneapolis and New Hope. According to Robbinsdale Area Schools, he attended Robbinsdale Cooper High School from 1997 to 1999. Then transferred to Robbinsdale Armstrong High School, which he attended from January to June of 2000. A spokesperson for the district says there's no record he graduated. According to Minnesota court records, McCain had a few encounters with police, mostly in the early 2000s, for driving offenses, disorderly conduct, and a minor drug possession charge. Most recently, he'd been living in San Diego. An acquaintance says he'd seen McCain in San Diego in March. Speaking from his apartment in New Hope, Isaac Chase, now 28, remembers meeting McCain after moving from St. Paul. He was 11 at the time and didn't know anyone. One day he was in the park near the complex and saw a group of bigger kids playing basketball.
Doug was the first one to pretty much, you know, ask me if I wanted to play basketball with him. So I started playing, and ever since then we've been cool and hanging out. We always play basketball from pretty much sunup to sundown.
Chase said McCain was funny and outgoing, a people person who advised him to do the right things. The last time Chase saw McCain was in 2008. He heard the news reports of McCain's death in Syria yesterday.
Yes, it surprised me a lot. Just knowing of him, he was a good person, so it really does.
Posts in McCain's Twitter feed say he converted to Islam 10 years ago. Friends and family posted condolences on McCain's Facebook page after initial reports of his death. The page has since been deleted. McCain appears to have known Abdirahman Mohammed, a Minneapolis man who went to Syria and joined the Islamic State. On January 2nd, Mohammed shocked his Facebook friends after he posted a photo of himself holding a rifle in one hand and the Quran in the other, with the caption that translates to Syria. However, McCain seemed to encourage Mohammed to fight. "Brother, don't listen to these people," McCain told Mohammed in a Facebook exchange on February 19th. "They wish they had your heart. Continue protecting our brothers and sisters." In a statement yesterday, a National Security Council spokesperson said, quote, "We continue to use every tool we possess to disrupt and dissuade individuals from traveling abroad for violent jihad, and to track and engage those who return." With reporting from Mukhtar Ibrahim, I'm Peter Cox from Minnesota Public Radio News.
Government-subsidized personal care assistants who work with elderly people and the disabled in their homes have voted to form a union. State officials counted the ballots yesterday in what ended up being a low-participation election. Tim Pugmire reports.
Labor organizers billed it as the largest union vote in Minnesota history. But only 22% of the nearly 27,000 eligible home health workers mailed in their ballots this month. The final tally was about 3,500 yes and about 2,300 no. Still, union supporters were celebrating the outcome. Deborah Housie, a PCA from Minneapolis, said she wasn't concerned by the numbers.
Yes, it doesn't matter. The vote is in. We now have a union. We are now not invisible anymore. We are a force to be reckoned with. We are 26,000 plus strong.
The vote means that the Service Employees International Union will now represent PCAs at the bargaining table in negotiations with the state. Working conditions vary widely for PCAs, and turnover can be high among those caring for non-family members. But a U.S. Supreme Court ruling earlier this summer said similar workers in Indiana could not be compelled to pay fair share union dues if they object. Summer Spica, a PCA and union supporter from St. Paul, downplayed the financial impact of that ruling on the new union.
I mean, again, it comes back to 60% of the people voted that they want a union, and with that, that's the majority, and we will move forward with that support and continue to change lives for ourselves and our clients.
The election was made possible by a law Governor Mark Dayton and the DFL-controlled legislature enacted in 2013. Democrats backed the measure while Republicans opposed it. GOP State Representative Tara Mack of Apple Valley said she was disappointed that such a big shift in policy was decided by so few PCAs.
If they were a bit confused and not totally sure exactly what was going on and the repercussions, I just am fearful that there's not a real firm grasp on what this means for folks. And I think, you know, we have to keep in mind a lot of the people affected, they day in and day out are, you know, up to their eyeballs in what it takes to care for their loved ones or disabled folks.
Union opponents went to court to try to stop the election, but a federal judge denied their motion for a temporary injunction last week, calling the challenge premature. But now that the election results are known, opponents plan to push ahead with a suit that claims the law allowing the vote is unconstitutional. The National Right to Work Foundation is providing legal help to a group of PCAs who brought that lawsuit. Mark Mix, the foundation's president, said in a statement that providers' First Amendment right to free association should not be put to any vote. He described the election result as the tyranny of a small minority. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Governor Mark Dayton is trying to stop the Fargo-Moorhead Flood Diversion Project, Dan Gunderson reports.
Preliminary construction work has started, and Governor Dayton took exception to the project moving forward before the Minnesota DNR completes an environmental review. Dayton wants the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to stop any funding for the diversion project. Diversion Authority Chairman Daryl Vanio doesn't expect the governor's letter to stop work.
It's a perplexing letter at best, but I don't know that it changes anything. Our plan is to continue until construction season's over.
Vanio says the Diversion Authority supports a DNR environmental review. An Army Corps of Engineers official says it will take some time for the agency to review Governor Dayton's request and respond. The nearly $2 billion project has been approved by Congress, but construction is not yet funded. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Moorhead.
There's a growing nationwide discussion about the use of body cameras by police officers after an officer in Ferguson, Missouri, shot and killed an unarmed teenager 2 weeks ago. In Minnesota, several police departments are using the cameras, and others are planning for them. But before police start recording encounters with citizens and suspects, departments and city officials first need to consider how and when the cameras will be used. Brant Williams has more.
Drop that knife. Drop that. Put that down. Put it down!
A Burnsville police officer draws his gun on a man carrying a box cutter in the lobby of the city's police headquarters. The encounter was captured on video by a camera worn on the officer's chest. The officer keeps his gun aimed at the man and calls for backup.
Sir, you're going to need to drop that. Drop the knife.
The grainy video shows another officer using a taser-like device, which stuns the man, causing him to fall to the ground. Burnsville Police Chief Eric Giesecke says his department was the first in the state to issue cameras to its officers in 2010. He says officers are required to turn on the cameras whenever they perform traffic stops and engage in other potentially volatile situations.
If they're involved with a confrontational citizen, use of force situations, obviously we want to activate it, and to record statements by the subject, victims, and witnesses. And it's a good tool when you're advising an individual of their Miranda rights.
Giesecke says officers are not required to tell people they're being recorded. Officers cannot edit the footage. And he says the department treats video like any other police document subject to government data practices law. He says the length of time video is stored depends on the type of case. Proponents of the use of body cameras say when encounters between police and the public are videotaped, both parties tend to be on their best behavior. Data recently collected by the Rialto, California Police Department support that claim. After Rialto officers began wearing the cameras, the department saw an 88% drop in complaints against officers and a 60% drop in the use of force by officers over a year's time.
I think where we have to be very careful is to think that this is the be-all, end-all.
Howard Wasserman is a law professor at Florida International University. He says the technology is very promising, but he says the cameras haven't been in use long enough to show they directly reduce complaints against officers and uses of force by officers.
I think what everybody's hoping is that it is going to have both an evidentiary benefit and a deterrence benefit for everybody.
Burnsville Police Chief Eric Giesecke says he doesn't have statistics to show the cameras have reduced officer complaints and incidents of use of force, but he says sometimes people drop complaints against officers after they've seen video of their encounters. Other cities are following Burnsville's lead. Spring Lake Park Police Chief Doug Ebeltoft says his department is in the process of replacing the squad car cameras with wearable cameras for officers. Ebeltoft says he wants the body cameras to activate automatically when the squad car lights are turned on.
That way then the officer will not have to manually turn the system on or off, and that it automatically starts when the light bar is activated for a traffic stop or responding to some type of call, whether it be a disturbance, a medical. And then when the officer gets to the location and exits the vehicle, the system is still running.
The Duluth Police Department also began using the cameras this year. Rochester and Minneapolis are still in the planning stages. A spokesman for the St. Paul Police Department says the capital city is watching how other cities use the cameras and will likely adopt the technology sometime in the future. Minneapolis Mayor Betsy Hodges is proposing to spend more than $1 million next year for the police department to start equipping officers with the cameras. A pilot program involving 36 officers is planned for this fall. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
And that's your Polycast for this Wednesday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.